All right, look again at Psalm 24. This psalm is called the Song of Ascension. Again, it's a prophecy of Messiah's triumphs, a prophecy concerning his satisfaction that he made on the cross, and his victorious ascension into the realm of glory. The fulfillment is seen in Acts chapter 1 and verse 9, 10, and 11. This is the scene where he was gathered, or had gathered his apostles together with him on the Mount of Olives, had commissioned them concerning the gospel work, the gospel kingdom, and its being launched forth into the world by the proclamation of the gospel. And in verse number 9, it says, "And when he had spoken these things, while they beheld, he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight. And while they looked steadfastly toward heaven as he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, which also said, Ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus, which is taken up from you into heaven, shall so come in like manner as ye have seen him go into heaven." In the latter part of this psalm, the question is asked, who is this King of Glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. The question is asked again in verse 10, who is this King of Glory? The Lord of Hosts. He is the King of Glory. The psalm is broken down into three parts, three stanzas, we would call them, it being a song. Verse 1 and 2 makes up the first stanza. 3 through 6 comprises the second, and then 7 through 10, the third. If we take it by stanza, there's a lesson in each section for us. First of all, the first stanza, verse 1 and 2, glorifies God by declaring his universal dominion. It starts out by saying, the earth is the Lord's. You know, that's never changed. Men might gain more and more possession of this earth and claim it as owners of certain portions of it, but this never changes. One generation passes, another takes its place. When one man leaves, whatever he leaves, his possessions behind, he leaves it to another generation. Is that not so? He takes absolutely nothing with him. And so, this is established. The earth is the Lord. It belongs to the Lord. But not only so, it says, and the fullness thereof. Everything in this world, on this earth, belongs to God. It's His. He's the proprietor of it. But notice he says, the world. I mean, it just seems to keep building here. The emphasis, God owns all things. Everything is God's possession. Even the wicked belong to the Lord, and God uses them at His will. He has the power to redeem your soul, or He has the power to damn your soul. And either way, God is going to get glory. He'll either be glorified in His grace, or He'll be glorified in His justice, in the eternal condemnation and damnation of the wicked. The earth is the Lord's. He made it. He created it. and the fullness thereof. Everything in it belongs to Him. The world. And watch this. And they that dwell therein. And they that dwell therein. And so he glorifies God as he begins this psalm by declaring his universal dominion. And the God that he glorifies here is Messiah the Prince. It belongs to Christ. Let me show you this. It belongs to Christ, this world, the earth and the world and all that's on it and in it, everything about it, belongs to Christ in three different ways. Number one, it belongs to Christ by creation. Creation is attributed to the Son of God. Look at John chapter 1. Notice this. In the beginning was the Word. That's Christ. The Logos. And the Word, Christ, was with God. And the Word, Christ, was God. The same was in the beginning with God. Now watch this. All things were made by Him, by the Logos, by Christ. And without Him was not anything made that was made. Not a single thing was made without Him. He made it all. It belongs to Him. He owns it by creation. Look over here at Colossians chapter 1. Notice in verse number 16. Here it is again. For by Him, Christ, were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible. In other words, what we can see, what's tangible, what we can touch, taste, and feel. It all was created by Christ. But not only the visible things, those invisible things, those things that we only have the testimony of the Word of God for, created things in heaven, angels, principalities, powers, all were created by Him. He says, whether there be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created by Him and for Him. Oh, how clear can that be? Created by Him and for Him. And then it says, and He is before all things. And by Him all things consist. They not only exist, but they have their consistence through Christ. And by Christ. Messiah, the Prince, the one that the psalmist is speaking of here in Psalm 24. But Messiah owns it not only by creation, he owns it by inheritance. This was a part of his inheritance when he consulted, when he complied to the purpose of God in the eternal council. God the Father had designated him an inheritance. Look at Psalm 2. Verse 7. Let's pick up there. Verse 6. Yet have I set my king, the same king we're talking about in Psalm 24, upon my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said unto me, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with the rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. In other words, you've got absolute control, dominion, authority over all creation. But not only does it belong to you by created act, it belongs to you by inheritance. It's designated to you as my son, who has accomplished all my will and all my purpose. Matthew 28 and verse number 18. We have it again. After his satisfaction, his passion had accomplished satisfaction on the cross, at his resurrection, the Father gave him this inheritance. And in this inheritance, all authority was given unto him. Notice it says in verse 18, and Jesus came and spake unto them, saying, All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Everything is answerable to me. That's what he's saying here. Everything, every man, every creature, every monarch, king, prince, president, is answerable to me. I have power, I have authority over all creation in heaven and in earth. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always. Why did he say it? Lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of this age. Assuring us that regardless of the opposition, this world belongs to him, and he moves it at his will, and his purpose, and his pleasure, to accomplish all his counsel. So he owns it by creation, by inheritance, and by purchased possession. He bought it. What about that? He owned it by creative act as its creator. He inherited it as a reward of his satisfaction to the Father's will and purpose concerning our redemption. And yet, it's sealed by his blood. It's a bought possession. He paid for it. Notice in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 22. And hath put all things under his feet, and gave him to be the head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him that filleth all in all. Paul is showing here what God did for Christ in answer to his satisfaction. He raised him up from the dead, set him at his own right hand, far above all principality and power and dominion, and every name that is named, not only in this world, but also that which is to come, and hath put all things under his feet. He's the possessor of it. He paid for it. He bought it by the shedding of his own blood. And therefore, it belongs to him. Now, here's the blessed encouragement to redeem sinners. Out of all of this, this is the blessing that you and I derived as being the redeemed of the Lord. He owns it, I say, by creation, by inheritance, by purchased possession. Look at Romans chapter 8. And verse 14, beginning there. Watch this. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. For ye have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear, but ye have received the spirit of adoption, whereby we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit Himself beareth witness with our spirits that we are the children of God. And if children, then what? Heirs. You see, as a redeemed sinner, I entered into the same inheritance that Jesus inherited. What He possessed by purchase price, by laying down His lifeblood, He not only bought for Himself, He bought for His people. Notice this. He said, if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ. You know what a joint heir is? That's an equal possessor of whatever the inheritance is. A joint heir is one that comes into joint possession with whatever the inheritance comprises. And in this, whatever Jesus owns, His people owns. If it said concerning Messiah the Prince, that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and all that dwell therein. That applies to you as a redeemed child of God. And it's, in the true sense, is so. The Beatitudes, we call them. The blessings, the benedictions that's pronounced upon the subjects of the kingdom of Christ. One of those benedictions is that you have inherited the earth. It belongs to you. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. That's God's children. We own it with Him. So those who are heirs of His kingdom neither have to beg, borrow, or steal. Whatever our Father sees that we have need of, He takes it out of His vast storehouse. His creation, His kingdom. And He brings it to us and sets it before us. When you sit down to a meal, does it dawn on you when you're praying over those victuals, those things that's been made accessible to you through process, through whatever the means may be that they've been... Do you sit down over those things and consider those things to be gifts by your Father? Gifts that have been brought out of His creation, made accessible to you. Oh, often I thank Him. Father, I thank You that You have brought forth these things out of Your creation and set them before us that we might take them and use them for our body's sustenance. But then if He's done so and been so benevolent to us in bringing these things forth, should not we also conclude that prayer by saying, Lord, now take these bodies that are sustained by these things and use them in Thy kingdom for Thy glory? What other purpose do we have in this world as the redeemed of the Lord except to be used in His kingdom and for His glory? So He glorifies God by declaring His universal dominion, verse 1 and 2. Secondly, verse 3 through 6, which comprises the second stanza of the song, He distinguishes the subjects of Messiah's kingdom from the rest of the world. Christ has a kingdom. One day, the kingdoms of this world, according to Revelation, will become the kingdoms of our God and of His Christ. That is, they are His soul now. But one day, in reality, He's going to take possession. Everything that man claims as his is going to be repossessed by the true owner, who is God Himself. But He distinguishes the subjects of Messiah's kingdom in this next stanza. They are those, first of all, whose acts are righteous. I believe God's children are distinct, don't you? I believe their actions, their activities, the things that they're involved in out here are distinctively marked out. I believe they're righteous people. I believe they work righteousness. They act godly. They live godly. They're sober people. And so he says in verse number 3, he raises the question, who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord? That's the hill of Zion. Or who shall stand in his holy place? Here's the answer, he that hath clean hands. And again I say, this first of all speaks to righteous acts, the activity of his people. Then notice, he that hath a pure heart. So not only are they distinguished by righteous acts, they're distinguished by inward purity. They're not Pharisees and hypocrites who only work for the show. Their platter is not only clean on the outside, it's clean on the inside. In their hearts are not like sepulchres full of dead men's bones and corruption. Their hearts are pure. They've not only washed their hearts or washed their hands in pure water, but their hearts have been washed and purified, cleansed by the blood of the Redeemer. And not only so, but they're distinguished by their affections. Their affections have been subdued. These all mark out and distinguish the children of God. Notice this, he that hath clean hands, that's outward morality. He that hath pure heart, that's inward purity. Who hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity nor sworn deceitfully. The affections of God's people have been and are being subdued. Then notice, look at verse number 5. He shall receive the blessing. That is, those that are so distinguished as are mentioned here in verse 4. That person, those people shall receive the blessing from the Lord. The righteousness from the God of his salvation. This is the generation, verse 6, that seek him, that seek thy face. O Jacob, or literally, O God of Jacob, Selah. So these are those, I say, who have washed their hands, yea, their bodies, yea, their souls, in the effective or effectual blood of the crucified Lamb. Then verse 7 through 10, giving the final stanza, speaks of the ascent of the Redeemer King, who opened heaven's gate and ushered in his glorious elect, his bride. Notice it says in verse 7, lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye lift up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, even lift them up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. Selah. Look at Ephesians chapter 4. In answer to this prophecy. I say, this final stanza speaks of the ascent of the Redeemer King, who upon his entrance into glory opened heaven's gates and ushered in His glorious bride. Verse number 8 of Ephesians chapter 4, "Wherefore He saith, when He ascended up on high, He led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men." What we see here is that great train of Messiah the Prince, judicially, His people being brought into the possession of glory with Him. It seems to be, as we look at this psalm over here, a shouting of the angelic beings as Christ approaches the glory world after His satisfaction being made on the cross, after His resurrection. It seems that the angelic realm in glory sing in great majesty, that is, with majestic voice, "Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye lifted up, ye everlasting doors." And the King, that's Messiah, Prince, who's coming from the battle, He's won the victory. His victory cry was, "It is finished," as He shouted that from the cross. He comes from the battle. We have a prophecy of this in Isaiah 63, I believe it is, when He comes from Edom. Who is this that comes up from Edom? His blood-sprinkled garments. "It's he who tread the winepress alone," was the answer. "He who speaks in righteousness," that's the King of glory. He comes into the portals of heaven. The angels demand that the gates be lifted up to allow the King of glory in. And then they seem to sing out in unison again in question form, "Who is this King of glory?" Then He's described. He's the Lord strong, mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. And so they cry out again, "Lift up your heads, O ye gates, lift, or even lift them up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in." And again in unison they cry out, they sing, "Who is this King of glory?" He's the Lord of hosts. He's the King, or the Lord of hosts. He's the King of glory. If you wanted to take the psalm and take the questions that's raised at the end of the psalm twice, "Who is this King of glory?" and then work back through the psalm, that is, going from the end of the psalm back to the first of the psalm, you could work it out like this. Verse 9 and 10, in answer, reverting back, proclaims His military title, His status as a military conqueror. Matter of fact, Spurgeon says concerning this, and especially referring now to verse number 8 in the psalm. Let me turn back over there to it. If you're not there, look at it again with us, Psalm 24. Where it says, "Who is this King of glory?" And then the answer comes, "The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle." He says the watchers at the gate, hearing the song, look over the battlements and ask, "Who is this King of glory?" A question full of meaning and worthy of the meditations of eternity. Who is He in person, nature, character, office, and work? What is His pedigree? What is His rank and what His race? The answer given in a mighty wave of music is, "The Lord strong and mighty." The Lord mighty in battle. And then Spurgeon says, "We know the might of Jesus by the battles which He has fought, the victories which He has won over sin, death, and hell. And we clap our hands and we see Him leading captivity captive in the majesty of His strength. And then He concludes His statement by saying, "Oh, for a heart to sing His praises, mighty hero, be thou crowned forever, King of kings and Lord." This is our King of glory. He comes from the battle. The smoke is settled. The victory has been won. And He enters in. But not alone. He leads captivity captive. That's us. That's His train. The elect of God, the bride of Christ, are led into the portals of glory with Him. And then there's the posting of His battle victories also that's seen in verse number 8. And then this question, who is this King of glory? Is answered by His mediatorial office that's also established here in verse number 7, where it says, "Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye lifted up, O ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in." Thomas Scott, the old Puritan, said this may represent the Savior at His ascension, demanding by His attendant angels admission into heaven. A man, or as man and mediator, yet at the same time as the King of glory, the Lord strong and mighty. James Morrison said, and what was the bright cloud which shone resplendently from off the mercy seat, from between the cherubims of glory, but an anticipated exhibition of that mystery of godliness? That is, God manifest in the flesh, the incarnate Christ. He emphatically is the King and Lord of glory, whose triumphant ascension to the portals of the celestial sanctuary was hailed by the shout of myriads of angelic bands who gladly threw open the everlasting doors to the glorified human nature. That's the great mystery of godliness, how that God could become man in one undivided person and remain so. And this is the King of glory, the God-man, Jesus Christ, who entered in His full humanity after the battle was over. And it must be so, because He came to redeem not angels, but human beings, flesh creatures like you and I. And heaven cannot be occupied with flesh creatures like you and I, except we have the God-man mediator in the forefront, leading us as His captives into the realm of glory. So this is the King of glory, the mediatorial prince. And then verse 3 through 6, as you work back through the psalm, answering the question, answers it by proving, again, the King's beneficial subjects. The question is asked, who shall enter into His holy hill, or ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who shall stand in His holy place? Well, only those who have been redeemed by the blood of the King of glory. They and they alone whom He brings with Him as the everlasting gates, the everlasting doors are lifted up. Only they who've been washed in that blood, who dipped into the fountain that flowed from His veins. They have clean hands and pure hearts and subdued affections, and only they shall inherit the realm of glory with their King of glory. And so He proves His subjects, His beneficial subjects. And then He finally, as we work back through to the beginning of the psalm, identifies this King of Glory by proclaiming his proprietorship. None other than Jesus Christ, the Lord of Glory. Jehovah of the host of heaven is proprietor of all things. The earth is his. The fullness thereof belongs to him. The world and all they that dwell therein. This is the King of Glory. And he's my king. He's my king. Is he your king? All right. We'll stand for a word of prayer and a hymn. Brother Ed's not in here with us. All right. Let's stand together. And let's sing 103, one of the favorite hymns of the church, Rock of Ages, Cleft for Me.